Chapter 14. The Cross. The cross is the commonest Christian motif. We find crosses in churches and chapels across the world. Some people wear a gold or silver cross on a chain around their neck. The danger is that the cross becomes something nice and decorative. It gets sanitized, far removed from the gruesome reality that the cross of Jesus truly was. Can you imagine wearing a miniature electric chair round your neck, or having on your church wall a replica of a criminal receiving a lethal injection? That's not an appealing idea. But crucifixion was a fearfully cruel method of execution, designed by the Romans to inflict the maximum pain for the longest time before the victim succumbed at last to death, which in the end was usually by asphyxiation. Tens of thousands were put to death that way, and Jesus was just one of them. So what made his death different from the rest? For a start, he didn't deserve it. As one of the two brigands crucified alongside him said to the other, "We're punished justly, for we're getting what our deeds deserve, but this man has done nothing wrong." It's not that Jesus just hadn't committed any major crime, but remained tainted by little sins and imperfections like the rest of us. He was free even of those. Everybody said the same. As we noted earlier, even his enemies, who would love to have pinned anything at all on him, were silent when challenged to do so. His friends said the same. These were his disciples, who walked and talked with him daily, sleeping in the same room and eating at the same table. If anybody could spot flaws, it would have been them. But they couldn't find any. Nailing this man to a cross, then, was a gross injustice. Second, Jesus didn't resist it. Normally, a condemned man would scream and struggle violently in a last attempt to hold on to life. Burly soldiers would kneel on his chest and hold him down while they hammered in the nails. But not Jesus. He hadn't even put up a verbal fight at his trial, when false accusations were thrown at him from bent witnesses. Instead, he was led like a sheep to the slaughter, and as a lamb before its shearer is silent, so he did not open his mouth. When it came to the actual crucifixion, he adopted the same unresisting approach. No one would ever be able to say he died reluctantly. In anticipation of that, he had once said, "I lay down my life," only to take it up again. "No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord." That doesn't mean he wasn't terrified at the prospect. As events moved close to his arrest and the appalling suffering he knew would follow, he spent time in the Garden of Gethsemane in prayer to his Father. Disciples Peter, James, and John were there with him, invited to keep him company at a time when, as he himself put it, "the sorrow in my heart is so great that it almost crushes me." They witnessed his mental and emotional struggle as he prayed out loud, "My Father, if it's possible, take this cup of suffering from me." But even as he prayed, he knew that the great Trinitarian purpose for him was to achieve victory through suffering, not by avoiding it or inflicting it on others. Thus he concluded, "Yet not what I want, but what you want." He would drain the cup of suffering to its dregs. And he did. This, the central act of all human history, is summed up by Mark, the Gospel writer, in the stark statement, "And they crucified him." It was his enemies, both Jewish and Gentile, who, representing us all, had combined to condemn him to death. At that point, he put into practice his own kingdom teaching that we should love our enemies. He submitted to the cross, calling down on his torturers not fire and brimstone, but his Father's forgiveness. In a way too deep and mysterious for the likes of us to fathom, All the world's evil came together to crush him, and he somehow absorbed into himself its full force. In doing so, he stopped its momentum, opening up a new era in which, through a spiritual change of heart, we now see within reach a life without violence, hatred, and sin. But at the time, with Jesus' death, bang went all the hopes of the Jews. The one they'd hoped would be the Romans' crusher had been crushed by the Romans, in cahoots with the Jewish authorities. Like every one of the upstart messiahs who had come before him, he had got the chop. The Roman juggernaut lumbered on, unslowed. True, there were a few Jews whose expectations of Jesus had maybe been a bit broader than most, like the 12 and the wider circle of sympathisers who had followed Jesus for 3 years. But the crucifixion silenced them too. A couple of them, making their weary way from Jerusalem, where the grim event had taken place, to their home in Emmaus, were typical in their despair. He was a prophet, they said, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. Those hopes were now dashed. As usual, death had had the final word. What exactly happened at the cross? How did it contribute to the working out of the divine purpose? In what meaningful way did it bring to a climax that long process of history we looked at earlier? We'll return to this as we review the signposts. Suffice it to say for now that this, Jesus' apparent defeat, was in fact his triumph. I know that turns all conventional thinking on its head, but it's true. The hymn writer Samuel Gandhi put it like this: "Through weakness and defeat he won the victor's crown, trod all our foes beneath his feet by being trodden down." The cross wasn't the end of the story.